Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Timber Living Log Cabins. For your perfect workspace, living space or hideaway, timberliving.ie. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Timber Living Log Cabins. Open your mind to a new way of living. timberliving.ie.
Good morning and welcome to the Brendan O'Connor Show. Dervil McDonald sitting in for Brendan this morning. Our panel have been very busy selecting the best and the rest of this morning's newspapers. But before I introduce you to them, let's take a quick look at the headlines. And it's quite a mixed bag of headlines this morning. The Sunday Times leads with Galway mother latest to die after Turkish surgery. Julianne Corr reports that a woman in her 50s died on July 15th last after undergoing an abdominoplasty at a Turkish clinic, becoming the eighth Irish citizen to die in the last 2 years after travelling to Turkey for medical or cosmetic surgery. The woman's daughter set up an online page to raise funds to repatriate her mother's body, an appeal that has raised more than €10,000 so far. The Business Post also has an alarming lead with Daniel Murray reporting that 15 separated children have gone missing from state care in the last year and are unaccounted for. That's according to a draft and as yet unpublished HICA report into the care of separated children seeking asylum in Ireland by TUSLA. TUSLA hasn't commented directly on the report because it is in draft format, but last week TUSLA's interim CEO admitted that the Child and Family Agency was at a crisis point. Crime in the capital is the focal point for many newspapers this morning following the unprovoked attack on an American tourist last week. The Irish Mail on Sunday carries an interview with the son of American musician Stephen Termini, who still remains in hospital after the assault. The headline there is "Attack on My Father is Proof that Dublin Isn't Safe." Varadkar vows to get tough on thugs after city attack. That's the lead in the Sunday Independent, which has a glorious picture of Kilkenny hurler Killian Buckley and his new bride Niamh Dowling following their wedding yesterday. The couple emerged from their ceremony to a guard of honour of guests holding hurleys over their heads, a blessing ahead of the Cats taking on Limerick in the All-Ireland Senior Hurling Final today. It's a fantastic image there by photographer Frank McGrath. The Sunday World carries a blurred CCTV image of a teenager it says was part of a gang of three teenage boys who attacked Stephen Termini, who was in Ireland to trace his roots and visit his mother's grave. The youth filmed the attack, according to that exclusive by Alan Sherry. The Irish Sun on Sunday carries a major preview of today's hurling final, as do most of the newspapers. And best wishes to the Bogue Shane McGowan, who recently spent some time in intensive care but is now on the mend. That's according to the Irish Sunday Mirror's lead, which is prayers for Shane. As it was yesterday, climate dominates the front pages of today's UK newspapers, with the Observer carrying a front page picture of uncontrolled wildfires sweeping across the Greek island of Rhodes, where some 30,000 people have been forced to flee this weekend, including more than 2,500 people who had to be ferried off beaches. Britain's leaders have been warned against a politically suicidal step away from their green pledges. That's the Observer's main story. It's a different story for the Sunday Telegraph, which leads with net zero can't become a crusade, citing a warning from Levelling Up and Housing Secretary Michael Gove that voters will revolt against what he says is the inflexible imposition of rules designed to reduce pollution. But climate is everywhere this morning. I'm sure we're going to get that. But first, let me introduce my panel to the studio this morning. I'm joined by David Carroll, Chief Executive Officer at DePaul, by Sive O'Neill, Coordinator of the Stop Climate Chaos Coalition, Sean Keyes, Financial Correspondent at The Currency, and Mark Garrett, Director General at the Law Society of Ireland. You're all very welcome this morning.
Thanks, David.
There's so much coverage. David, I might just start with you. So much coverage right across the newspapers on crime in the capital. Just one of them, for example, this inner city makes me want to holler at McEntee, just one of the columnist's contributions. But you're from the area. You grew up there in the northeast inner city. You have huge connections still to there. What do you make of some of the coverage?
Well, it's all over the place, Dervil, isn't it? Everywhere within the papers. And I think one of the... having grown up in the northeast, in the inner city, in East Wall, and knowing the areas that we're focused on, I think the important message to get across is that this is not a reflection at all on the communities within those areas. And it's hugely important that we all kind of recognise and realise that. I think let's look at the wider perspective in terms of what cities such as Dublin kind of experience from a safer cities perspective. I think our hearts go out to the man that was attacked. But Dublin is probably experiencing kind of issues that other cities have faced, and the opinion piece in The Independent this morning kind of highlights what New York has done, for instance.
It
says that, look, if New York can kind of deal with issues of this nature, Dublin can. Going back to that theme, DePaul also work in other cities in Ireland, in Derry and in Belfast. Belfast is experiencing issues in terms of the visibility of say, for instance, begging and street drinking and a whole city centre initiative has been pulled together there involving Belfast City Council, involving all of the health related agencies as well. And I think looking at where we're going to go with this, one of the big features, policing is important. Of course it is, and needs to be at the forefront in terms of visibility. But also let's think of the other kind of initiatives that we need to kind of put in place in order for a longer term solution around how we create a safe city for Dublin.
Sean Keyes, he's right, isn't he? Because Dublin is not the only city on this island, or indeed anywhere else that is experiencing problems like this.
That's right. I mean, something happened around the world to, you know, a lot of countries simultaneously. Obviously, COVID happened, but something beyond that to cause these public order problems in big cities. And obviously, it's something to do with, you know, the changing office market and the changing demand for space and all that sort of stuff.
And populating inner cities with large amounts of commercial blocks and tenure. And, you know, what's remarkable, I think, about the Northeast inner city is that its population has surged hugely in the last decades, but huge pockets of disadvantage, but also huge pockets of affluence.
Yes,
yeah, mix by side. Of that part of the city.
And I mean, leaving aside, sort of related to but separate to the public order thing, is if you look at the office market, the demand for office space, and there looks like a permanent downgrade, you know, reduction in demand for office space by about a quarter or a third or something like that. And it doesn't seem to be coming back. And it would make you wonder, I mean, that the purpose of Dublin City and all of these cities has always been workers come in, workers go out, workers buy things, workers get their food and they leave. With a permanent reduction in workers, it's going to have to find a new role for itself. The role is going to have to be residential, from what I can tell, and that's where public order comes into it. I mean, it's really essential if Dublin's going to find its next act as a residential hub. It has to feel safe.
Yeah. A lot of the tone, Simon Neill, as you know, David has already pointed out, on the Northeast inner city is perhaps a little bit unfair and unkind, and yet at the same time, this attack was particularly savage.
It was dreadful, absolutely horrific, but it's certainly not the first one. Having said that, I have to say that all the coverage that I looked at this morning was somewhat troubling. It was all focused on policing. And in fact, say, to take an example, the Irish Mail on Sunday quoted Minister Helen McEntee, who's under quite a lot of political pressure at the moment to deliver a response. She's quoted as saying she's focused on building stronger, safer communities. But what she means by that is increasing sentences, recruiting more Gardaí and making the Gardaí that are there more visible, so having a more visible presence. Now, some of that might be absolutely necessary, but I don't see that that's going to deliver stronger, safer communities. And as an environmentalist, I suppose I'm interested in exploring that. What does it take to make a successful urban space and community?
And even the Taoiseach, I think Leo Varadkar in the lead in the Sunday Independent this morning, at least acknowledged there are a lot of factors at play.
There are. So if you actually study Dublin and Dublin City, there's huge discrepancies, for example, between the north side and the south side of the city in terms of public open spaces, even the numbers of trees available, the density of accommodation, the air pollution and the kind of concentration of certain types of public services, particularly needle exchanges and drug treatment facilities. So communities in the areas talk about these issues directly and have been calling for more resources to support them, to also create programs for young people. But in none of the coverage did we see people exploring those kind of issues. What are the drivers behind that kind of social decay? Because you have like gentrification and decay right beside each other.
Margaret, there's no doubt that policing is a significant issue, not least the rise in the population, and obviously the Garda retention hasn't kept up with that. But it seems to be a lot of the coverage is very, very simplistic, as if policing alone is the silver, kind of the magic bullet, without interrogating the reality of the lived experience of people who live in these communities.
No, absolutely. And I think, you know, the initial shock of the viciousness and the unprovoked nature of the attack is quite understandable. But I think there's a number of other bigger picture issues that have already been touched on. And I think maybe to draw that even further, I think leadership in the city matters as well. And I think there's an article on page 2 of the Business Post about who's going to take over in Dublin City Council.
Kind of buried on page 2 of the Business Post, I would have thought.
I think it's very connected to actually asking the question, who has the convening power to actually pull together all the connected or unconnected agencies, the community, and those in the voluntary and community sector who want to get involved?
Because there are particular initiatives that have worked, particularly partnerships, or where you have Gardaí covering very, very specific areas, and the visibility that the communities are not just being policed, but are also in partnership.
Absolutely. And what we see in other cities, there's no doubt about it. We see, I mean, Sean mentioned the point around New York and what has been done. I mean, the reality is that's been pulled together by the mayor of New York or other agencies involved in that. We see this in other cities. And I think we're beginning to come back to the issue of an elected mayor for Dublin. Yeah. But even at cabinet level, there's no cabinet level office that would pull that together. And I think that's something that's really missing in the city.
Who comes in next after Owen Keegan? Is that going to matter to the future vision and the future feel of this city that we're broadcasting from?
It should, but it probably won't, because DCC is quite toothless. It's very, like, we should never forget, Ireland has a very unusual system of local government. It's very underpowered. It's got a small budget, very little responsibility, and we've got very little accountability. If you look at the process by which the new Dublin City Council Chief Executive is going to be picked, they'll be picked, I believe, by the Minister. There's a kind of a process, but it's essentially by the Minister and then ratified by the Council. And my point is, okay...
Do you want an elected mayor?
I do want an elected mayor. And it's not just about convening power. It's, as we mentioned before, it's about, that's which is important. Like, you need someone who can bang heads together and kind of make things work, make things happen at city level. But also, there's this idea that I don't feel like the message is bubbling up from ground level in Dublin, you know, in all of our cities and towns, that there isn't a politician who's out there anticipating people's problems and saying, okay, there's something going wrong here.
What about that? When you look at the northeast inner city, I used to work there. It's an eclectic part of the city, and I really enjoyed actually working near Talbot Street, where this was actually the site of this attack. But look, Sean McDermott Street, Ballybox, Summerhill, you know, Northwall, Sher Street, it's home to a number of significant areas of disadvantage, but it goes all the way from Connolly Station to Croke Park. You know, it's a very, very big area that has also seen the largest percentage population of new communities in Ireland. But we're not really hearing enough, when Sean's talking about agency, from the voices of the people who live there. And it's something that's being picked up in our text messages from listeners.
The great pity this morning within the coverage is that there are no voices from the community of what they want and how they see their communities developing within the coverage this morning. Mm. And whatever structures that we put into place going forward, we need to listen to the established communities within those particular areas. I'm a trustee of a school in the northeast inner city. And I tell you, the amazing kind of staff, but the amazing parents that are there as well, who have huge hope and aspirations for their children, the same as any other parent in this country. And how do we get the structures in place in order to be able to inform what needs to happen within communities as well? I think the point with regards to the future vision of where we go has been made. You know, what is going to be the mix between commercial kind of development? What is going to be the mix between social housing and cost rental and private? Because there is absolutely a need to bring life back into our city. And we want it as a vibrant living entity.
And we want people to live in the cities, don't you, Simon?
We want people to live, you know. So there's this huge initiative around working above the shops, or living above the shops. And DePaul Housing are involved in a number of initiatives where we're trying to bring housing forward in that whole area. But that's a huge kind of opportunity in order for us to be able to deal with the specific needs, for instance, around single homeless people. You know, 60% of those within who are homeless are single homeless. We need to find solutions and housing options. And the inner city is a way of getting that kind of vibrancy back as well. But the most important thing is, how do we listen to people's voices on the ground?
And is it complicated that you have that mix, David, of, you know, high levels of disadvantage, but also significant levels of affluence as well? And how does that affect the dynamic of a community?
I think the business links with the community are key, and we will be kind of linked with a number of agencies, for instance, ALG, who have a presence in the area, have a really, really big focus on community development and supporting community. So that link between businesses, what they're bringing, creating employment opportunities for people from communities within whatever businesses do come into the area, you know. So the promise would have been made to the Northeast Inner City, we have all of this development on your doorstep. We've got so much kind of commercial development. I suppose what people are saying is, where are the jobs for us? You know, this is on our doorstep, you know. And so therefore, that kind of employment related development linked to whatever commercial entities do come in. So that the businesses that are in the Northeast Inner City feel that they have a stake, and they're not just kind of coming back and forward and making their profits. They have a big role to play in support and let's say the communities in the Northeast Inner City are flourishing as well.
If I'm
at home listening to this, it's almost like, you know, from the Northeast Inner City, are we subject to kind of...
But isn't that the interesting thing, though, Sive, about the Northeast Inner City, that it has seen marked spikes in both affluence and disadvantage? You know, it's what makes it a really actually very, very interesting part of the city to live or work in. But it's a dynamic that needs to be managed. And a lot of what people are texting in, they really do think it's a lack of visibility of Gardaí on the beat. Someone says, "I'm rogue individuals, Derval, causing trouble. It's not confined to Dublin or even other cities. There isn't enough sanctioned Gardaí or powerless to deal with the problem." One says, "We spent 10 hours in Dublin City Centre yesterday and saw precisely zero police. Dublin is a city of extreme rich and extreme poor with zero policing in the middle." Jackie says, "It's obscene to me to see such a contrast." And another says, "I find it fascinating that nobody has raised the fact that a lot of this stems from the breach in the social contract. Many young people don't see a viable future by doing what many of their parents have done."
Yeah.
Sive.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point about the social contract, because again, coming back to Minister McEntee's point about building stronger, safer communities, what does that look like? And they have to be something to do with shared values. And one thing I would say is that the local authorities have a really critical role to play in shaping the physical environment in which people live, in terms of their planning policies, in terms of their traffic policies, and everything else. And housing, absolutely central. And while these might seem like very abstract issues and not related to thuggery on the streets, it all matters. Everything matters. If you want to build a successful city, a successful urban environment, there are plenty of examples. And where you see them successful, you see diversity, you see action to reduce dereliction and decay. You don't see whole areas being dominated by high-rise, either commercial or hotel developments, right beside where people live.
But Mark, people don't want to hear that. You know, when you look at it, they just think the answer is just policing, more visibility, and, you know, and lock them up and throw away the key.
I think where there's consensus on this panel is that there's nothing wrong with more visible policing. In fact, we're all saying that that is part of the solution.
It's not an instead of,
that it's actually a more complete picture. And again, it's not just confined to Dublin, and we don't want to single out any one community. But it's very clear that we have been very good at dealing with crises over the last number of years, perhaps. But in terms of longer term planning, in terms of longer term investing in all sorts of support structures, which builds those stronger societies, we clearly now have a very strong economy. We're wondering what can we do with these surplus tens of billions over the next number of years. And I think that ultimately what we're all saying here is, how can we invest those for a better society for all of our citizens?
Do you feel safe in the city, Mark?
Generally, I do, I've got to say, but you can't take away from, obviously, individual incidences. Personally, I've got to say I do, and I've lived in that part of the city for over 10 years, and I live in Dublin 6 now. But I've got to say that you know, in general, the city is safe. I think the stats show that. But I think the lived experience for people, individual incidences like this do, as you see, life-changing injuries for this individual is quite shocking.
And but of course, and it wasn't the first, the Taoiseach in Kiev earlier, in Ukraine earlier this week,
exactly.
You know, speaking to a wonderful Ukrainian actor, I actually got to see in that beautiful Brian Freely's translations, who had also been attacked in the area. David, you're from the area. Where is there a dynamic, and how can that dynamic be managed?
I think what we need is a vision. I think we need to, for instance, in that kind of area, going into Sheriff Street, going into Talbot Street, is a longer term perspective of how that area is going to be developed. And that has to happen in partnership with the communities themselves. For instance, that whole area around Seville Place, kind of, and the older type buildings there. I would want to guarantee from the Five Lamps down to Sheriff Street that those buildings will be retained and used for residential kind of going forward, and they're not hoovered up for hotel or commercial kind of use, because I think there's an encroachment or a danger of encroachment. And we've got a real kind of a vibrant approved housing body sector now, and we may talk about the housing kind of piece later on. But we have, and it has been said already, we've got the money at the moment from a capital and one-off payment.
With everyone and who is making demands on it.
Everybody's
on its
making
use.
Demands, but if we are going to be able to take a longer term vision on this, the northeastern city is the one area that will bring positives for everybody, tourists, the community themselves, the commercial, but a vision and approach of how that whole area is going to be developed going forward.
And finally, Sean, just before we take a break, I mean, you live not too far away from the area. Has it changed in your view, or do you feel safe in the area?
I do feel safe, yeah. It has changed. I mean, I'm sort of a blow-in, arguably gentrifier, been there for 5 years, and there's been big investments, like in public realm, like there's new that fantastic cycle highway, the road in that leading down to the river, and all the public realm around it. There is work being done, but I mean, what strikes me, like, obviously crime is very complex and multifaceted and difficult to solve. But like Sive's point, I'm a big believer in like public realm having and the environment kind of infecting people, and I just think that's an easy problem to solve. You know, North Dublin has been like empty of trees. It's been, the public realm has been kind of neglected and forgotten about for a very long time. And I just wonder why is that? You know, why are these simpler problems that would be cheap to fix not being solved?
Well, we'll have to just reflect on that as we just go to a quick ad break. But with me and staying with me, I hope, in studio are David Carroll, CEO at DePaul, Sive O'Neill, coordinator of the Stop Climate Chaos Coalition, Sean Keyes, financial correspondent at The Currency, and Mark Garrett, Director General at the Law Society of Ireland. We'll be back in just a few moments.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
You're all very, very welcome back. Well, once there was a time when there was a complaint that there wasn't enough coverage of climate in our media, there is no escaping it and no avoiding it now. Mark Garrett, you picked out a piece by Matt Cooper, his column, which maybe captured for a lot of us kind of the confusion. He's sort of writing away from a short break to Croatia saying, I kind of feel guilty about the flights and I eat meat, but
at the same time, he's obviously capturing a lot of maybe the conflict, perhaps, but also the facts, right? I mean, that if there was ever any more evidence needed to back up the case in terms of the action required to address climate change, I mean, he talks about the Atlantic off our west coast is 4 degrees higher than normal in recent weeks. I mean, that's maybe for someone like myself who is going to Mayo, back to Mayo next week for holidays, that might be beneficial in the short term, but we all know the consequences of that. And I think that's going to be an issue. But I think perhaps the biggest concern is, you see, we talked about the front page of the Sunday Telegraph about the potential voter backlash about policies. We see that in, there's this election in Spain today.
And ironically, Labour lost out in Uxbridge to a policy that Boris Johnson had championed, albeit by a very, very small margin. But
absolutely. And we're seeing much more of what we're seeing is this being an issue of a backlash from voters in Spain and the Netherlands, potentially now in the UK. And I think the real challenge is to make sure that the policies that are in place or that are needed gain the momentum over the next number of years. I think we don't need any more evidence. We know what the challenge is. We know the problem, and we know that decarbonisation and all the other policies that need to be put in place, but the difficulty will be bringing more voters, more members of the public with us on that, in that
David,
journey.
There's a lot of coverage about that, just in terms of a broad acknowledgement of the scale and extent of the problem, but perhaps missteps about how to go about it and bring people on board, or the risk of alienating them as well.
I think there's a real dilemma, I think, and you can see the pressure on the Green Party trying to kind of bring policies in place. And I think Matt's piece in terms of Ireland not fully kind of appreciating that we're actually in the middle of this.
Because it's raining.
I'm
not being that simplistic, but he's just saying perhaps because we haven't experienced directly like what we're seeing in roads, what we're seeing, you know, elsewhere, that perhaps are we a little bit distant or immune from it?
But I think we only have to look at what's been happening in terms of flooding, say, for instance, in Cork, or even the torrential rain that happened last night. I was coming back from the cinema last night, and
Barbie or Oppenheimer?
Oppenheimer, but Barbie's next, Darvel.
I myself have had a Barbenheimer weekend, but we talked about that.
I think I need a little bit of pink in my life.
You need Barbie as the palate cleanser. Yeah, absolutely. So is it that the sense that perhaps it's not literally on our front door, even though it is?
It is on our front door, and we've got really tough choices to make over the next couple of years of what we're actually going to do. And what we don't want to happen is that we live with the consequences. It's not too late, and I'm sure Sylvia will talk more about that. In terms of for what we can do, we can't ourselves give up on actions that we need to take, where I have a specific focus is on the whole housing issue. And we've got a golden opportunity with all of the housing development over the next couple of years to make sure that we are as environmentally...
To future-proof
our housing.
Can I just bring in Sive there? Because recently Minister Eamon Ryan, you know, was taking issue with some activists by saying, you know, you just can't be berating people all of the time because you need to bring them along. And obviously concerns about, you know, the just transition. But there's sort of some commentary in the papers this morning kind of speaking to that.
Yeah, it's quite interesting looking at the coverage of those UK by-elections because we obviously have elections coming up next year, local and European elections, followed by a general election. So there's a few elections at the moment that are happening that will give us a foretaste of the kind of way the politics of climate change is likely to evolve. And it's no doubt about it, but the politics will be difficult. So for about 10 years, the climate activists and scientists were fighting for governments to take responsibility, to set targets, to accept net zero and to accept the climate science. But once they've done that, the challenge is now to move into implementation. And that's where it comes into people's houses.
That's where it rubs.
We want to take your boilers. We want to take your cars. The perception is that it's all very punitive and the politics are going to be difficult.
Well, so what happens? It's going to require investment
require all of those things, but it also requires a communication strategy. And it also requires responsible media coverage. So while there is a lot of media coverage of climate change and the heat waves in Europe, the reality is that most of those...
The 20 articles yesterday.
It was extraordinary. And it was fantastic because it covered so many issues. It covered defence actions. It covered community gardens, agriculture and farming. It covered a whole range of things. But today's papers actually skirted around a lot of those deep dives and instead look at the kind of weather issues. So we're still talking about weather, what's likely to happen
it's
to Ireland, what's likely to happen,
time.
What's likely to happen to your holiday, where will you be holidaying next year? And that really fails to join the dots in the public attitudes. So if we don't make the connection with fossil fuels and the need to get them completely out of our economies, it's no wonder that the public is confused. And just to give you an example, the only piece that I came across that addressed that issue head on was Caroline O'Doherty's piece in the Sunday
Independent.
And, you know, she points back to the way that there was a lot of hope after James Hansen addressed the House of Congress talking about climate science. There was an acceptance that this was real, it was happening, and that everybody would get behind it. And then what happened was the fossil fuel industry got on board and started advertising and confusing. Now, we still have that happening. We still have it happening in much more subtle ways. But the reality is that if we want to get the public on board, we need to make sure that, and to quote one of the headlines in The Observer, that climate action is not weaponized. So any problems that particular parties have in implementing policies, whether it's ultra-low emission zones in London, shouldn't be seen as a broad rejection of green policies. It's John a lesson Keys. For us to do better, to communicate better, to get people on board and to drive the sort of changes. But what's really interesting about that ultra-low emission zone in London, which triggered this win for the Conservatives, is that the actual policies there are really good. So it's not just about introducing a congestion charge. There's actually a scrappage scheme, not just for private vehicles, but also for vans, and very generous mechanisms to exempt people who own and use cars within the London area from the congestion charge.
It wasn't enough to oust the Tories from Boris Johnson's seat. And the fact is that climate has been weaponized. It is one of the biggest front lines in our culture wars. Mm. Can you see a kind of UK-US style kind of debate developing here?
I think environmental politics would be best to accept that people are. I'm more cynical maybe than Sive. I think people don't like to be inconvenienced, and I think that doesn't necessarily mean that the climate is doomed. But I think it requires a different strategy for solving the problem, and it's the strategy that if you take that skeptical view and say, okay, if people aren't really gonna cut back on their meat consumption, what are we gonna do about it? It requires things like things that maybe the environmental movement, aspects of the environmental movement aren't too happy about, such as tons of concrete, tons of steel, transmission lines running through the center of the countryside, huge infrastructure projects, and there's a sort of a fight for the soul of the environmental movement, I think, between people who prioritize the climate above all else and a group of people who prioritize sort of minimizing, our footprint on the environment more generally. And I think, just given the way I feel about humanity, I think we have to go with the former. We have to build a lot and we've got to decarbonize the grid.
Do we have to just go with the alarm? It's interesting what David Quinn, writing in the Sunday Independent, said is that the most alarmist voices are being amplified. He was talking about the semi-apocalyptic headlines about heat waves in Southern Europe. And he was saying that he put his cards on the table. He said, I believe climate change is real, but it's irresponsible to keep frightening people with predictions of, end of days.
Well, look, I mean, there's a couple of things there. But first is the science is irrefutable at this stage. And I think, Sives made the point that it took a long time to get to that place where we were able to say on the very basic facts of
why are we losing that opportunity so quickly then?
Well, I'm not sure we are. I think we're only getting, as Sive again has said, we're only getting to the implementation phase of a lot of these policies. And I think it's wise to think about that some of them may work easily and find an easy path, and others may not. And I think it's always worth looking at those. And I think if you take those low emission zones in London, for example, the balance between charging people for those emissions versus the scrappage scheme. I mean, there's a call to, it's about 100 million is being used as part of the scrappage scheme.
Trying to change behaviours, ultimately.
We're trying to change behaviours. But I think it's the balance between the carrot and the stick. And I think the idea, the imposition of over £12 for somebody who has a car with excessive emissions, where is that burden falling? Perhaps those least able to afford it. And I think the exemptions that Sive was talking about, maybe highlighting those, but also increasing the incentive to change those cars and change those in a way. So I think if the investment is much more towards the carrot, I think people are reacting against the stick. And we're seeing that not just here, not just in the UK, but we're seeing it in the rise of parties, populist parties in Spain, in the Netherlands, and elections that are ongoing right now. So it's not just an Irish phenomenon, it's not just a UK phenomenon. No. We're seeing this. And to learn the lessons of those is to implement those policies well, adjust as we go, but knowing what the overall goal is.
Yeah, and Dave, just on that, because there's a lot of concern, well, how is the just transition, which obviously has become something of a cliche, but how is that going to be managed? Because a lot of the time it is people who are most disempowered who will be affected most by climate change.
But also as well are the ones who we need to motivate and incentivize in order to be able to take action themselves. It's very difficult to try to kind of say to some people, you need to make more sacrifices when you're on low pay or that you're unemployed. So how do we work with people in order to make that connection between what their own life experience is?
And they may not be able to afford a brand new car. They could have one of those older cars.
And absolutely, or the transport system doesn't exist for them to get into work, into a low-paid job in the city centre from a suburb. And that's the point that I wanted to bring back to, you know, we have the Land Development Agency this week talking about major kind of developments. What we have to think in terms of is the transport infrastructure of these new communities that we are building. And that's done in a sustainable way, because many of those people will maybe turn to their cars rather than taking public transport if the bus doesn't. Sometimes I get the bus from Whitehall, Dunnecarney, into the city centre, and I have to have 7 buses passing me on the Malahide Road before I get a bus. So we have to fundamentally look at how we motivate the person, the ordinary person, in order to be able to take individual action.
Clive, you're the Director of Communications. What do you do?
Well, all of these issues are really important and they're really complex, and I don't have one answer for them, but all of them are so important that it just shows how we need to make climate action, I suppose, the central mission of the government and its strategies. And it's very important that we maintain what does appear to be a good, strong, broad, cross-party political consensus on the need for climate action. It's very welcome to see Sinn Féin supporting the climate law and the carbon budgets. But I suppose there is a concern that leading up to the next set of elections, that parties will be tempted to undermine each other because of local objections to whatever it is, your cycle lanes, your this, your that, whatever, the infrastructure that Sean was referring to. And just to make the point that the environmental movement is broad and diverse. The climate movement is broad and diverse. And in my coalition, for example, we have representation from the National Women's Council, International Development Organization.
Is there divergence within it, and how do you handle it?
There's a lot of different issues at stake. First of all, there can be some competing and issues and trade-offs when it comes to sort of biodiversity and nature conservation and infrastructure. All infrastructure that we add has to contribute to the decarbonisation goal. So there may be some trade-offs. We need to develop this, but it'll help us decarbonise somewhere else. But we're going to have to make difficult decisions, and they need to be made at a local level, and they need to be made at a national level, and they also need to be made in our state boards. And one of the things that troubled me, and this goes to a general point about advertising and the role of advertising in kind of shaping our desires and our consumer behaviour, but there's a couple of front page advertorials, or sorry, not front page, but full page advertorials by Gas Networks Ireland. And Gas Networks Ireland has some very interesting strategies now about hydrogen and renewable gas. And I'm not saying that they're doing anything illegal or in any way unethical, but there is a problem when the Gas Infrastructure Agency is promoting its activities with full page ads at a time when we need to be absolutely getting off our addiction to fossil fuels, including fossil gas.
But Mark,
gas.
Arctic, you can't ban ads. You know, you can't.
You can. I mean, this is the thing. In France, for example, they've introduced quite strict regulation now about advertising of carbon-intensive products and cars.
And do you
particularly
think that's an initiative?
And car advertising is all over those newspapers that we were looking at this morning.
Yeah, and Mark, they will. And look, I mean, the strategy is to get us off our fossil fuel cars and into electric ones, but not to ban them altogether.
Yeah, well, I see that as one of the issues being brought up by Michael Gove in the UK is to push back the date from 2030 about the banning of fossil fuel emitting run cars. And I think those are the issues that are going to come up now in practical terms. I mean, outside of Dublin, I mean, the vast majority of people heat their homes through an oil tank in their back garden. I mean, how are we going to get to a place where we can ensure that people, you know, can heat their homes during the winter? And I think these are big
Keyes,
challenges.
We have the solutions for that.
Sean Keyes, doesn't that mixed messaging, isn't that reflected nearly actually in Matt Cooper's piece? There is a sense of make us chaste, but not just yet. Yeah. We're all navigating ourselves through this.
I mean, there's, in fairness, where our political parties have acted honourably, and there's a good consensus there. But I don't think that the consensus among political parties reflects, if you poll the people, I don't think that the actual ordinary people are quite as on board with this as the political parties are.
The amount of us flying out of our ports to go on holidays might suggest that maybe we're a little bit conflicted with our conscience. I wanted just to go to the lead story that was in the Business Post by Daniel Murray. I wonder, do we have Daniel on the line just to chat about that? Daniel, welcome to the programme.
Thanks very much for having me, Dervil.
Yeah, look, your Business Post front page details how 15 separated children have gone missing from state care, and how the number of separated children in state care has increased from 90 at the end of 2021 to 260 today. First of all, Daniel, who are these separated children, and where do they come from?
So separated children are children that arrive into the country without any parents or legal guardians, and they're generally seeking asylum here. And the numbers, as you say, being referred to TUSLA and arriving into the country have increased dramatically in the last year and a half in particular, along with a dramatic increase in immigration more generally. The breakdown of children currently in state care that are separated children is a mix. About 80 of them are from Ukraine, another 80 from Afghanistan, another large portion from Somalia, and then a kind of scattering of countries around the world, generally very poor countries, generally countries that are engaged in conflict as well. So coming from a variety of different places.
Do we know the age group of these children at all? You know, are they kind of 16 or 17-year-olds just about to reach the age of majority? Are they younger? Do we have any sense of the profile? Because from what I understand, they either arrive on their own or with a group of adults, and then they're identified as being separated.
Exactly. Look, there's a mix, obviously, that come over, but predominantly it's people that are kind of mid-teens. So you're talking 15 to 17 years old, and they arrive in a variety of circumstances, mostly either through Dublin Airport or presenting at the port. And they are assessed by immigration. If they have a claim to be, underage, under 18, that's something then that has to be assessed. And sometimes there's disputes over whether people are actually over 18 or under 18, and sometimes they don't have documents to prove it. But generally, you're talking about children between the ages of 15 to 17, assessed by immigration services, referred on to TUSLA, and then taken into state care. And what we're reporting in today's paper is that it's these children that are being subjected to these kind of ad hoc special emergency accommodation arrangements, which is basically just privately leased accommodation, which came in for a lot of criticism in the news last week.
And obviously, TUSLA has admitted in a separate context that it is at a crisis point, at a breaking point, and we have these ad hoc systems. The big concern must be with the separated children is the risk of trafficking or other forms of exploitation.
Yes, certainly it is. And as we've detailed in today's paper, over the last year and a half, there's 15 separated children that have gone missing and are unaccounted for. Now, there's actually 25 children that have gone missing, but 10 of which have returned, which raises its own concerns as well. But 15 that have gone missing. And TUSLA had said to me that there are circumstances whereby some of these kind of mid-teens children will indicate that they plan on moving on or going to other countries, maybe even going in and reuniting with family. So there can be legitimate reasons. But the point being that they're unaccounted for, and these children are particularly vulnerable to exploitation, sexual exploitation, possible trafficking. And a recent report from UCD highlighted how children in state care, separated children and Irish children in state care, are becoming targets for sexual predators looking to try and get them into the sex industry. So it is a big concern, and something that the Children's Ombudsman in today's Business Post is also raising as a concern, saying these children are particularly vulnerable.
And finally, just really, if it's ad hoc arrangements, I suppose that even just speaks to the general crisis with housing asylum seekers in general. Minister Roderick O'Gorman, how does he hope to address it?
So he, over the last year and a half, they have increased the number of residential centres. So these are specific purpose-built centres whereby children are, separated children are looked after in groups. And they've built another six of these in the last year, or at least opened another six of these in the last year. He wants to open more of these to try and get children who are being kept in these ad hoc arrangements in privately leased accommodation with far less oversight, far less care supports, and are therefore far more vulnerable, to get more of them into these residential centres. But that's something that's going to require more resources. It's something that he's going to have to discuss with his cabinet colleagues at the budget. So it could be a while before that's addressed. What I do know is that in the next couple of weeks, the Children's Rights Alliance has been asked to convene a stakeholder meeting with all of the key NGOs and TUSLA and the government in this area to try and come up with solutions for what is being described as a serious crisis.
It is indeed. Daniel Murray, political correspondent at the Business Post, thank you for that update. David, all roads, sometimes it feels, leads to housing.
Well, I think, first of all, I'd like to say that I completely agree around the vulnerability of the children that are not being located and identified. We're undertaking a piece of research at the moment, DePaul, on the whole area of modern slavery. And I think one of the issues is, you know, the whole kind of sexual and exploitation and employment exploitation of individuals as well. I think it's not just a housing issue. We have to remember that these are children and need to be treated under the legislation as such, and need and should get the same support that other children in the state receive. There is obviously an issue in terms of us catching up on this issue, in terms of the amount that have actually come our way, the amount of people, young people that have come our way. But in terms of the state services need to keep pace. And again, as you say, the longer term issue with regards to people who are in direct provision and young people as well, and their housing futures is obviously key.
Mark Gard, with so many of the guidelines and legislation around this potentially being breached, there must be an exposure for the state here as well.
Yeah, well, look, I think it's been a long-standing issue that the resources and the structures, the support services and even the legislation around these areas have been weak for some time. I mean, the Law Reform Commission, I think, first identified in the 1970s the need for significant reform in the family and child law. And we've had, actually in the law side, we had a recent conference with a number of significant judges from England and Wales, just highlighting the contrast between our system. And there is legislation now coming through in terms of a new family law structure, which will be beneficial, but also the support structures that go, all that go with that. And David's talked about housing and all the other supports that go with it. So we have a long way to go here. I think internationally, we are promoting the Irish commercial law system as something to laud and do, business in Ireland. But I think, you know, when it comes to family law and the support for vulnerable children in this case, but also I think the court system and the legalities around that, we're far behind.
I think it jars a lot of time being one of the wealthiest countries having to cover stories like this. We're going to take a very quick break.
Text 51551. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
You're all very, very welcome back. And no, I am not avoiding RTE because, Sean Keyes, there is plenty of coverage across the newspapers today, including one, I think, that was at the off-lead in the Sunday Independent by the CEO of Virgin.
Yes, CEO of Virgin pointed...
He
pointed out that RTE is spending $20 million on importing content from other places, serialized
such
stuff.
As,
oh God, I know. If I go to the RTE app and it gives me a lot of Frasier. That sticks in my mind. Seinfeld was there for a while, and I guess his point is, and I think it's a fair point, is in it gets at what's RTE for? Why do we have it? Is it just to be a general entertainer for the people, or is it to tell Irish stories and to do Irish journalism? And if it's the latter, then you have to wonder, what's the point?
Is it the point, Mark, that maybe if it's one of your favourite soaps or whatever, you can get it elsewhere? Or do people like kind of continuity, that they need to know that after the news are going to be able to watch whatever they want on their...
Yeah, I must admit, I don't have an issue with it myself. Yeah. I've got to say, the idea that RTE can be a general entertainer and provide a public sector broadcasting at the same time, I think it's one of those areas. If you're not bringing the audience for those entertainments, how are you possibly going to get those that public broadcasting messages across as well? So I must admit, unsurprisingly and quite rightly, you have Virgin Media pushing their own case because they're a competitor of RTE in the circumstances. So I'm personally, I've got to say, I'm quite comfortable with that mix.
There was a very quick poll as well, Tone, in, I think it was one of the papers in the Sunday Times, with a little caution that comes with polls.
Yes, it was. So Behaviour and Attitudes asked, the question was, should Ryan Tuberty return to the airwaves? The poll was conducted July 12th to 17th, which is just after his appearance at the Public Accounts Committee, with Noel Kelly. Sample size is 1,014 people. Anyway, the answer was...
There was no margin of error, though, was there?
No, it wasn't provided. But it was evenly divided, so they found 40% of people thought that he should come back, 41% thought that he shouldn't. 18%.
And I guess that will continue until we actually know what the actual outcome of that is. But look, I do want to get back to the roads, because earlier today, TUI, the travel company, said that the wildfires in the southern part of roads that we heard about is affecting their operations and holidaymakers are being evacuated. Paul Hackett is president of the Irish Travel Agents Association and he's going to join me quickly on the line. Paul, how many Irish holidaymakers are likely to be affected by this?
Rhodes has relatively few flights out of Ireland. Ryanair operate two flights a week and TUI operate two flights a week. So at any given time, there would be 700, 800 passengers on the island at any given time.
Yeah, and look, I mean, looking at the huge numbers, local official in Rhodes said they'd moved 30,000 people threatened by the wildfires to safety. And as I said earlier, more than 2,500 who'd be ferried off the beaches. What happens to holidaymakers? Obviously, I'm sure they'd be relieved not to go anywhere that's unsafe. But what are their rights, Paul, when something like this happens and their travel is interfered with?
Well, the Package Travel Directive, provided consumers have booked with travel agents, Package Travel Directive and safety for consumers. And TUI would be the main operator to the island cancelled flights in the immediate couple of days. Now, you know, it's important we keep this in context. Rhodes is quite a large island. The airport is operating as normal. Rhodes Port is operating as normal. And all of the resorts in the north of the island are operating as normal. The resorts in the south of the island, where the fires are in Lardoss, are impacting some of the major resorts like Lindos. Mm. But other parts of the island, it's almost like the bottom third, so to speak, Derval, is impacted at the moment. So what needs to be done is those holidaymakers obviously need to be moved to safety. TUI are being very cautious in, rather than bringing passengers into an island where the hotels are already closed due to evacuation, they're just not taking those passengers to the destination and they're taking the passengers that are their home.
Yeah, it is extraordinary, and I'm sure some people might be thinking twice perhaps if they're due to head out this week. But for now, Paul Hackett, President of the Irish Travel Agents Association, thanks a million for joining us and at short notice. So let's go then to the All-Ireland. A feeling this panel is a little bit unbalanced. Is anyone supporting Kilkenny?
Oh yes, I'm from Kilkenny.
Sive.
I lived in Kilkenny for 20 years, but I am absolutely the worst spokesperson for the county, because I'm not really a big sports fan. I am one of those people who will watch the All-Ireland final if Kilkenny is in it and enjoy it immensely and then retire from sports for the rest of the year. But it looks like a great match. And I'm also excited to report that the Waterford team, I live in Waterford now, the Waterford Camogie team is going to be in the All-Ireland final in the next couple of weeks as well. So that's very exciting for those of us in the southeast.
Mark Archer grinning there effusively.
Yeah, well, look, I enjoy watching the hurling final mostly because I'm from Mayo and I don't have to put up with the potential heart attack and the roller coaster of emotion that comes with watching Mayo football. So look, I really enjoyed reading James O'Connor in the Independent today, who said that the Scalda Cats will fancy this one, but great champions can find an extra piece of skill when it comes to when needed most. I think it just summarises how close people feel this one is going to be.
Sean Keyes, the dominance of Limerick in recent years.
That's right. Well, I'm from Limerick, and it's a bit hard to get your head around. It still hasn't.
Because Limerick was always rugby.
Well, Limerick was always rugby, yeah. And I'm from Limerick City. When I was growing up, it was so rugby. You know, it was all AIL and Shannon Rugby Club and all of this. I understand now that at underage level, hurling dominates Limerick City. You know, it's mixed feelings.
Yeah. What would you do?
Well, to welcome in the pantheon of the Dubs, come in with successive All-Irelands. But Shane McGrath's piece on the ballet required to keep education, work and romance and sport aligned is incredible. In terms of highlighting the sacrifice that these guys make. And no matter who wins today, the incredible skill and athleticism that's on show there today is incredible for an amateur sport.
Yeah, no, it's going to be absolutely thrilling. And thank you. That's all we actually have time for in terms of our panel. I want to thank David Carroll, Chief Executive Officer at DePaul, to Sive O'Neill, Coordinator of the Stop Climate Chaos Coalition, Sean Keyes, Financial Correspondent at The Currency, and Mark Garrett, Director General at the Law Society of Ireland. Thank you all very, very much. And just coming up to 12 o'clock, let's go to the newsroom and to Susan Jackson.